I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we will be exploring, as we have on some previous editions of the program, the issue of sanctions and their negative impact on countries like Venezuela, Syria, Iran, and others. Joining us to do that is Professor Alina F. Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Sanctions. Professor Duhan joined me from Belarus for a conversation that clocked in at around 50 minutes. She was very gracious with her time, and I believe that our conversation was chock full of important information. So, with that in mind, let's get right to it with Professor Alina Duhan, the UN Special Rapporteur on Sanctions. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Dr. Alina Duhan. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
So I wanted to have you on because you do special rapporteur work in regards to sanctions. And I guess before we delve into some of the questions I had, maybe you could explain for my audience the kind of work you do as a special rapporteur.
The mandate of the Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures is one of 44 thematic mandates which have been established by the Human Rights Council to be able to provide expert assessment of the situation of the impact over human rights in specific countries as concerned the of various sorts of activity. In my situation, my mandate is not relating to a single type of human right or a single human right only, but it refers to the assessment of the impact of application of unilateral sanctions to all categories of human rights anywhere around the world. And we speak here about the assessment of impact of all categories of sanctions, targeted sanctions which affect specific individuals, or the sanctions which affect companies, spheres of economies, countries as such, or even secondary sanctions. For example, when we speak about imposing sanctions for violation of already existing sanctions regimes, or developing and applying national civil and criminal penalties in order to implement sanctions. Well, as any other special rapporteurs, my purpose is to collect materials from all possible sources, from states, from individuals, from non-governmental organizations, any other members of civil society, to analyze and verify this information, because non-verified information can be used to do expert analysis of the various situation on the, in my case, on the impact of unilateral sanctions on human rights, in sometimes in specific situations, like, for example, last year, my report to the UN General Assembly was devoted to the assessment of impact of unilateral coercive measures on human rights and the cause of the pandemic, to draft reports to the Human Rights Council and the UN General Assembly. Beside that, take into account that sometimes certain countries are more vulnerable or are more affected by application of unilateral sanctions, to do country visits. And this year I did two country visits, one in Qatar, another to Venezuela, to deal with communications which come from states, individuals, NGOs or companies. As a result, I can draft a communication to send it either to states or to private actors or to banking system or to non-government organizations. Another, my purpose is to raise awareness about the problem. And as concerns my mandate, it's very important to take into account that the understanding of unilateral sanctions itself is very low. The vision of unilateral sanctions is usually very much politically motivated. And therefore, there is a huge political debate and nearly no human rights and, in reality, legal debate in this sphere. And to do that, I'm doing interviews. I'm communicating with scholars. For example, a week ago, I had a huge expert consultation with academics from different parts of the world. I do academic articles as being a professor. I consult and I negotiate with non-government organizations because they can provide valuable information and their work is affected by unilateral sanctions a lot. Therefore, we try to amplify our efforts. And naturally, I try to talk to the United Nations organs, as well as other non-government international organizations, as well as states, to explain the impact and to explain the problems which exist and to try to find a solution to be able to protect human rights better.
So when we talk about unilateral coercive measures and sanctions, what do we mean? And I know that seems like a basic question, but I think it's important to address because there's also different kinds and types of sanctions.
That's a very complicated question, I would say right now, take into account that the terminology which identifies unilateral measures taken today is very diverse. We speak about unilateral coercive measures, as in the title of my mandate, we speak about unilateral sanctions, unilateral targeted sanctions, we speak about security measures, defense measures, restrictive measures, and many counter sanctions, countermeasures, lots of different forms. And unfortunately, the use of all these various forms of terminology doesn't provide any clarity to know what we are talking about in general. And therefore, for example, my report to the Human Rights Council this year will be devoted exactly to that point. My purpose is to analyze terminology and to provide, to demonstrate what types of unilateral sanctions exist today and to provide legal qualification of most of that types from the point of international law. Because if we do not know what we are discussing or what we are talking about, no one can ever decide whether it's legal or illegal and what's its humanitarian impact. When we speak about the types of measures which are exist and which, let's say, maybe started to be qualified as legal or illegal from the point of international law, it's necessary to say that the kinds of types of sanctions have expanded today a lot, even if we compare with situation which existed 5 years ago. Traditionally, the UN Charter provides only the UN Security Council with the capacity to decide about applying military and non-military sanctions in the situations of the breach of peace, threat to peace, or an act of aggression. So the UN Charter doesn't speak about unilateral sanctions at all. However, today we are facing a situation when lots of states and regional organizations are unilaterally deciding on imposing unilateral targeted measures when they identify that a specific individual or a company shall be the activity shall be restricted in the way, for example, the assets freeze or prohibition to enter the territory of the country because he, she, or the company did something. Or probably because sometimes even these individuals are not accused in committing any sort of crime. Sometimes they are listed because they are relative or related in one way or another to another company or to another individual whose behavior is disliked by a state or regional organization. So generally speaking, the first time is targeted sanctions imposed against individuals and companies, either for alleged committing international crimes or just crimes or violation of human rights, which not always can be qualified as a crime, or just being, let's say, a member of the government, which is disliked by the country or non-recognized by the country. Or, for example, in the situation as it took place in Venezuela, when opposition calls for all the opposition members not to participate in parliamentary elections, those opposition parties which took place in election, their leaders have been listed. So they are under sanctions. Sometimes another types of sanctions is the situation when sanctions are imposed on the sectoral basis. So generally speaking, when all companies or individuals involved into a specific sector of economy are under sanctions, and therefore we may speak, for example, about the oil and mining and gold sectors of Venezuela economy, a number of sectors of Cuba economy. Mining, metal, and forestry, if I'm not mistaken, sectors in Russian economy. So generally speaking, that basically means that all residents of the targeting country are prevented or prohibited to deal with that sectors of economy in the targeted states. And generally speaking, naturally, it has, if the whole spectrum of economy is prohibited to be involved into economic activity, naturally everyone working over there is affected a lot. Then the next type of sanctions we are also facing is freezing assets of a specific states. Generally speaking, here we also face serious problems because, for example, the assets of central banks of states shall be immune of any foreign jurisdiction, even in the case of any disputes, and including economic disputes existing between the states. However, in this case, it doesn't work. So the assets of these individual, of these central banks are frozen. And today we're speaking about frozen assets, for example, of central banks of Venezuela, of Syria. It may also happen that sanctions are imposed against a state as a whole. As for example, recently Cuba has been announced as a state-sponsored terrorism by the United States, and as such, new restrictions have been imposed. But these sanctions are sanctions which are directly prescribed in their documents. Unfortunately, today we face lots of new types of sanctions. And when it's said that sanctions are traditionally targeted, they target only bad guys for doing something wrong, and they do not target good people, that's definitely not the case. Because now we come to the point of secondary sanctions. Every state which seeks to implement sanctions it has already decided to impose drafts legislation which provides for civil fines of the very higher level, as well as for criminal penalty, including the imprisonment, and sometimes quite a long imprisonment in the United States and can be up to 20 years in jail for violation of sanctions regime. Another example is, for example, the European Union Global Human Rights Regulation adopted recently provides as one of its position obligation of all European Union member states to draft civil and criminal penalties to prevent any steps to overrule sanctions regime. And that basically makes people and company to get scared to violate the rules, even if they do not know whether they are violating that rules. And now we come to this next wave of sanctions, we come to the point of overcompliance. So companies are so scared to deal with companies or individuals from countries where sanctions are imposed or to the individuals of which sanctions are imposed, that they stop any transactions, banking transactions, interaction, and so forth, because of being feared to be sanctioned or face civil or criminal penalty by itself. And as a result, we come to this secondary wave of sanctions. And what's happening is a new wave. A number of countries recently, like, for example, China or Russian Federation or some other countries, started to impose counter sanctions over companies and individuals in response to sanctions imposed already by the state, nationality of which this company have. So unfortunately, this regime of sanctions becomes more and more complicated. But from my point as an expert, the most important element is to assess whether activity taken by a specific state is in accordance with international law. And it's necessary to take into account that international law doesn't prohibit all sorts of unilateral activity. There are certain grounds when states can act unilaterally in order to influence behavior of another state, but all these criteria shall always be checked.
That was the next question I was going to get into, was how does the question of human rights and the abuse of human rights arise in regards to how sanctions are used?
Aspect of human rights observances relating too much and relating to every aspects of application of unilateral sanctions. So the very first point is that quite often the human rights abuse is cited by sanctioning states or regional organizations as a ground to impose unilateral sanctions. And moreover, quite often it's announced that sanctions are imposed with the purpose to protect human rights. Unfortunately, it's necessary to say, first of all, that the general announcement as a sort of common goods, from one side is naturally good, but from the other side, you can't take illegal activity in order to achieve something good. You could only take the activity which is legal from the point of international law. And secondly, it's absolutely necessary to take into account humanitarian aspects. Before I start answer your question, I will give you an example of practice of the UN Security Council. In 1990s, the UN Security Council started to be very active in deciding about imposing of comprehensive or economic sanctions, that was even called the decade of sanctions. And these sanctions were absolutely legal from the point of international law. However, what's happened afterwards? After 10 years of sanctions, the United Nations, as well as a number of non-governmental organizations, started to do a sort of humanitarian assessment of impact of this absolutely legal activity. And it has happened that humanitarian impact was enormous in the countries like Iraq, for example. And when humanitarian NGOs provided information that the death rate of children beyond 5 was plus 500,000 to the traditional rate within 10 years, these figures appeared to be really scary. When the level of malnutrition rose a lot and children have no vaccination and no sufficient food basket and education suffer and poverty rates rise and hyperinflation rise, then the UN Security Council started to do the humanitarian assessment of its activity very often, permanently, systematically, and moreover, it stopped to impose economic sanctions. But situation with the UN Security Council sanctions is much easier because, first of all, these measures are legal. Secondly, the UN Security Council doesn't impose too much of sanctions, so the number is limited. It's clear where to check what is listed, and it's not fast to impose additional sanctions. And therefore, measures taken by the UN, implementation of sanctions by the UN Security Council, didn't result in the enormous levels of overcompliance. When we come to the level of unilateral sanctions, first of all, we need to take into account that, for example, when we speak about the targeted sanctions only, so the sanctions imposed against a specific individual, his rights are already affected. It's usually discussed that these sanctions are targeted, they imposed against bad guys only. But the first questions from the point of law is, who is a bad guy? I remember when there was a change of president in the United States recently, and in one day, President Trump turned from the very respected president, being a good guy, into a person who was named a bad guy. People supporting very much blocking of his accounts in Facebook and many other social networks. People do not have the right to qualify someone to be a good guy or bad guy and to punish immediately. There are court procedures. Everyone shall enjoy the presumption of innocence. A person could be announced to be guilty, especially when it comes to accusation in committing of crimes, including international crimes, only upon the court verdict. What's happening today with sanctions? Countries quite often do not intend to start a criminal prosecution if they have jurisdiction. Again, as an example of the United States, there are a number of people who are listed as committing cyber fraud against nationals of the United States, and US has jurisdiction in this case. These people are listed, but I haven't heard about the attempts to start a criminal case against these individuals, because if there are sufficient grounds of a criminal case and sufficient level of evidence, all the assets can be frozen as well. But the rule of law will be observed. Information about these individuals won't be published everywhere, and these people will have the right to enjoy all procedural guarantees. If they are guilty indeed, they will face a criminal penalty, as it shall be done. The same exists when we speak about international crime. There is possibility of universal jurisdiction in some cases. There is possibility to bring a referral to international criminal court, but there shall be jurisdiction first, and the level of evidences shall be sufficient. However, what's happening today, individuals are listed very fast without any court verdict, without any real consideration of case. They are publicly announced to be bad guys and sometimes international criminals or just criminals. And quite often, the possibility to appeal this decision and announcement are nearly non-existent. So it's a little bit better within the European Union, but within the United States, there is no possibility to appeal the case to the court. That's the case when we face situation of individuals targeted. When we come to targeting of companies, as I have already mentioned, not only owners, but all workers of companies are affected because the company can't get impact anymore in the way it used to. It can't pay salaries, and therefore people lose their jobs. The general level of economy is falling. When we come to sanction the whole sectors of economy, situation is even broader. When, for example, the oil sector of economy has been listed and has been sanctioned, generally speaking, it's stopped. The oil revenues in Venezuela dropped from 100% to 1% only. The whole country doesn't get impact. People are losing their jobs, so they live in poverty. They can't guarantee their basic needs. Additional impact is done when sanctions are imposed to over the governmental funds, as well as the any possibility to trade with a specific government. In a reality, it turns into impossibility of buying all sorts of goods, including medical equipment, medicine, spare parts, food, spare parts to maintain vital infrastructure, like, for example, electricity, water supply, gas, gasoline, and many other spheres. And naturally, if all the country becomes targeted as a result. So if you have nothing to eat, if you have no clothes, and if you have, for example, water once per week, if you have no access to medicine, and if you even you find so gasoline to get to hospital, there is no possibility to do the simplest blood test and to prescribe you a medicine, naturally your rights are violated, all categories of rights, including the right to life. And all this is exacerbated by overcompliance with sanctions, because, for example, I have spoken to a huge number of humanitarian NGOs which deal with delivery of humanitarian aid to targeted society, and they see that they shall be very selective because donors are scared to provide assistance if it will be delivered to countries targeted by sanctions, because they are scared as a sort of overcompliance to be targeted by themselves, as well as the humanitarian organizations and their staff have repeatedly been sanctioned. They themselves are facing asset freeze or freeze of their bank accounts.
So it sounds like these sanctions sort of interact with or exacerbate already existing issues within the nations that have been, you know, targeted with sanctions.
Yes, indeed. Naturally, there is no ideal country around the world. Situation may be better or worse in different countries. And naturally, specific political or sometimes military, in the case of military conflict, or economic problems already existed in a number of countries which have been sanctioned afterwards. At the same time, and naturally, these countries quite often are accused in having corruption or mismanagement or bad governance or human rights violations in the country. However, the practice shows that as soon as these sanctions started to be imposed over the country, the humanitarian situation becomes much worse. So again, as a result of my recent country visit to Venezuela, people lost access or lost partially or in full to medical assistance. Medical assistance used to be provided by the government 100%. And I can give you a couple of figures, just not to speak in a, like about abstract things. There is a huge child cardiosurgery hospital in Caracas. This hospital used to do 1,500 surgeries per year. So cardio surgeries for children. And that was sufficient for the country, 1,500 per year. As for now, because they are unable to buy spare parts and reagents, they are only able to do slightly more than 100 surgeries per year. That basically means that 340, 380 children do not get their cardio surgeries per year. For some of them, it means risk to life. For other, it means a really lower quality of their life. The same situation exists when there were impediments, so the assets have been frozen and the money couldn't be transferred to PAHO, so Pan American Health Organization, and UNICEF to deliver vaccines, to vaccinate against, for example, malaria or measles. So these diseases are treated very simply by vaccination. You do not need to get sick if you are vaccinated. But as soon as the country couldn't buy vaccines for children, children started to get sick with these diseases, and these diseases are really dangerous. The same situation exists, another example from my recent Venezuela country visit, in the serious cases of brain, marrow, and kidney cancer. Children were getting transplantation of brain marrows and kidney in Italy and Argentina. After sanctions have been imposed, all assets have been frozen, and children do not get transplantation anymore. For these children, it's a matter of life and death. And the same situation exists in all spheres of economy, or in all spheres of diseases, chronic diseases. When we refer to Iranian situation, after 18 last Iranian banks, not listed before, have been listed by the United States recently, Iran lost all possibilities to buy insulin, for example. That's really deadly for lots of diabeticers. I have read reports about prices jumping enormously at the black market because new insulin is not coming to the country, but it doesn't settle. Sooner or later, this insulin at the black market will be over as well. And therefore, impact over human rights of the population is enormous. And all the reports I see, imposition of unilateral sanctions deteriorate city human rights situation enormously.
So there were just maybe a few more questions I had, if you have the time. One thing that I wanted to delve into was the idea of the right to development. How do these sanctions impact the right to development? And also maybe we should, for listeners, what do we mean by the right to development?
Right to development is a pretty broad concept that basically is referring very closely to the concept of sustainable development. It basically means that all people all around the world shall have the possibility to develop the society. So the concept of sustainable development, for example, speaks about the interrelation of three main elements: economy, environment, and humanitarian needs. At the very closely related initiative, there is a list of the sustainable development goals which shall be achieved by 2030. And these goals are established by the UN General Assembly. As concerned the right to development basically means that all individuals, in the simple words, so all individuals all around the world shall have the possibility to enjoy the highest attainable level of health, education, housing, work, and so forth. So basically, people shall enjoy the right to decent life, access to medical assistance, be able to write and to read, because in some countries it's still a problem. Today, in the situation of development of cyber infrastructure, to have certain level of computer literacy. So basically, the right to access internet and human rights in internet announced by the UN General Assembly around 15 years ago, we are a part of this right to development strategy. To be able to communicate to other people, to get educated by yourself, to get the possibility to have normal housing and normal food. And when we speak about the development, if you, people need to have some job, you need to have work and places. And therefore, building infrastructure, building industry, developing a country, going in the spheres of the green economy, making the labor not just having a job, but having a decent labor and having a green labor, which will be healthy for yourself, are also important part in this sphere. And therefore, there is a very close relation between the right to development and unilateral coercive measures. It's reflected in a number of resolutions of the Human Rights Council, the UN General Assembly. It has happened, unfortunately, that beside the when unilateral sanctions are imposed over a country, it traditionally result that country has less money, less economic resources it used to have before. Moreover, it has to deal with problems it didn't deal before, like if you can't buy the medicine or food, you can't import food and medicine at the same price you used to have, or you can't buy it directly, you need to look for some sort of mediators, and it will be more expensive at the result. Some countries, like for example, Sudan, referred that the price rise, including food price rise, was up to in 3-5 times. So 3-5 times price rise. And therefore, it means that the quantity of available resources is even lower than just having it impossible to sell some stuff. And as a result, the very first step, which will be usually done by countries, will be to guarantee the survival of the population. So the basic needs, basic medical care, basic food needs, like for example, in Venezuela, people are getting food baskets. So when I speak about food baskets, I'm not speaking about economic term. I speak about the basket with real foods like crops, oil, anything else. And in this situation, naturally, the state will stop developmental projects first, because the developmental projects like getting higher level of education, better quality of internet supply, or developing new areas of economy for improving the environmental situation, protecting the environment in specific areas, this project will stop first, and that will undermine the right to development in general. However, the very fact that application of unilateral sanctions is affecting basic human rights, like, for example, the right to housing, right to food, right to health, and even right to life, it also undermines the basic grounds of the right to development.
So one thing that I noticed you've covered lately in your position is the issue of U.S. emergency declarations and the problems that arise from permanent states of emergency. Could you talk a little bit about that? I think this was in reference to the Rewards for Justice program. Could you discuss your thoughts on that?
Indeed, announcement of the state of emergency is used by the United States as a ground to introduce a higher level, a high number of and high quantity of sanctions. It's not only relating to the Rewards for Justice program, and therefore I will split this question into two. Today, in order to demonstrate the existence of jurisdiction to impose unilateral sanctions, the United States are announcing the state of emergency as referring that activity of specific government, individuals, or certain types of activity are endangering security of the United States. Sometimes the situation look extremely strange, and I will cite here, for example, the situation when the United States imposed sanctions, issued the executive order to, entitling the United States to impose sanctions over judges and officials of International Criminal Court. Because the International Criminal Court adopted a decision that it has jurisdiction to investigate crimes committed by the US and US-controlled personnel on the territory of Afghanistan, although the United States of America objected this jurisdiction. And as a result, the United States has announced that it creates a threat to the security of the United States and announced a state of emergency. And as a result, with that state of emergency, it announced the possibility to impose sanctions. So happily, very recently, less than a month ago, another executive order decided that no sanctions will be imposed under that executive order, because that undermines the immunity of judiciary in this case, but nevertheless, this executive order existed for nearly a year. In all the other cases, like situation in Cuba, in Venezuela, situation of international terrorism, the state of emergency is announced, and unfortunately, it exists in the United States already since 1975, permanently. It existed for a long period, starting from 1930s as well, but there was a break around for 5 years in 1969 to 1975, if I'm not mistaken. But unfortunately, when one speaks about international law, the state of emergency providing for the possibility to step aside from certain categories of human rights is understood absolutely differently. So the state of emergency announced by the United States has nothing to do with the state of emergency, the possibility of which is provided in Article 4 of International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. In this case, the state of emergency shall be announced only in situation when the very survival of the people, of the population of the country is endangered. The measures taken shall be proportionate, and they shall be taken within the country, not outside of the country. They shall be very limited in time. However, in our situation, we face the state of emergency announced worldwide, activity taken worldwide, measures applied extraterritorially to individuals and companies or countries worldwide, and being permanent on its nature. And struggle against international terrorism is one of these spheres, and that's basically where the Rewards for Justice program is established. It has been initially established to propose a sort of reward for information about terrorists which can't be arrested. So that was an initial idea. Unfortunately, today this program is against with the reference to the state of emergency. Unfortunately, today this program is applied extremely broadly. Like recently, the hackers initially, and as it was initially announced, the Russian hackers, which have probably intervened into the election process of the United States, have also been within the system of the Rivals for Justice. And today, individuals which in reality have nothing to do with this Rivals for Justice program have also been announced within that program. And what's happening from the point of international law when we speak about this program? An individual, no criminal case against which has started, is announced to be a bloody terrorist with his hands all in blood. And a huge reward is promised for these people, as practice shows, without checking the identity of individual, what exactly he or she is doing, no attempt to start criminal case, and no attempt to talk to that individual. I have reported about situations when people who have been listed for working for a company in, for example, in Iran or in some other country, have been for a state company in Iran, have been listed because of working for that company and doing their job. And therefore, they have been announced as terrorists and the reward is promised for their life. Let's take it personally. A single individual doing his or her everyday job is announced worldwide to be a bloody terrorist. His or her picture is everywhere, and it is on the official web page or Twitter of the United States governmental body. Naturally, these people start to be scared, even for their life. They are scared that someone will steal them, kill them, or do anything else to get this reward. And therefore, naturally, this sort of activity is not in conformity with international law in the same way as the announced state of emergency is not in conformity with standards of Article 4 of ICCPR. And I would like to draw attention again to the fact that the wrongfulness of this approach to the state of emergency has been repeatedly cited when analyzing reports of the United States as concerns its observance of obligations coming from the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
So the last question I had, you know, in looking at things like sanctions, and you mentioned the sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s, it's really just horrible, the effects of those sanctions. And I think we're seeing the horrible effects now during the pandemic. Do you think, what are the other options we have in terms of international relations other than using these type of unilateral coercive measures? Or how can we respect and uphold human rights while also dealing with a lot of issues in international relations?
That's a question which I'm quite often asked, and I believe that that question is very uneasy. I think we have lots of diplomats which we're supposed to respond, but I will try to respond from my expert perspective and the position of the special rapporteur. The very first point is that, upon my opinion as an expert, states shall take activity in accordance with international law. That was exactly the purpose why they drafted international law. In particular, if a state is not disliking activity of another state, it can decide not to be involved into economic or any sort of relations with that state, but not in the way of sanctioning the state or sanctioning all individuals or companies of that state, but in the way of not concluding a treaty, cooperation, investment, or any other treaty. That's absolutely legal. States may decide to stop diplomatic relations, and that's also legal. That's a mechanism of demonstration of disapproval of the activity. That's a way how the sign that the dispute exists between the state and this activity is absolutely legal. If the dispute is really severe, states shall use existing mechanism of peaceful settlement of international disputes. I'm very happy to the fact that today countries started to bring so-called sanctions cases to international judicial institutions. There is, for example, now a case brought by Iran to the International Court of Justice against the United States for referring to the violation of the treaty on amity. And this case is now considered by the International Court of Justice. There is also a referral brought by Venezuela to International Criminal Court, referring to the fact that unilateral sanctions constitute an international crime. So involvement of judicial institution is a means to settle international disputes. When we need to struggle against violations of human rights, there is a huge scope of human rights mechanism within the United Nations, as well as at the regional level. There is a Human Rights Committee, there is Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, there is Committee on Torture, there is Committee on Prohibition of Discrimination, and many other of them. These are the mechanisms which can legally be used and which can help to improve situation with human rights. I do not even mention discussion of situation within the Human Rights Council as well as other bodies. In these situations, when, for example, we speak about committing international crimes or just crimes, and we can prove the fact of existence of jurisdiction, those who have committed crimes shall face criminal charges. That's absolutely legal, and that's what helps to prevent committing international or national crimes. But this mechanism is not used. Sanctions are used instead. Again, if one state has violated international law, international law provides for the possibility to apply countermeasures to the state which has already committed a violation towards this state. These measures, however, shall be proportionate to the violation, shall be necessary, shall be temporary. Sanctions quite often are not temporary, shall have their aim to restore violation of international obligation, and shall never violate fundamental human rights and international humanitarian law. Sometimes, naturally, the level of violation of international law is so enormous when we speak, for example, about situation of aggression or genocide or apartheid or situations of ethnic cleansing, that the case is affecting the whole world. So in this case, countermeasures can be taken by any other states, not only the directly affected states, but again, with due account of proportionality, necessity, goal, as well as prohibition to violate any human rights. So indeed, today we have legal mechanisms which can be used. And it's not, so international law doesn't provide to split individuals to good guys and bad guys. Each of us is deserving the whole scope, to deserve the whole scope of human rights. I will give you an example of Nuremberg Tribunal, which has been established after the Second World War. There was a very active discussion whether these people who were accused in committing international crimes, awful international crimes, deserve the right to defend themselves, to have a defendant. And if I'm not mistaken from the history of international law, that was exactly the United States of America, which was insisting very much that every individual, including international criminals, shall obligatory deserve all rights of judicial protection. And as a result, today, the judicial protection, right to fair trial, and procedural guarantees are obligatory to be provided to everyone accused in any crime, including international crime. Why shouldn't people who are not accused in committing crimes enjoy these rights? So therefore, my opinion is that in order to protect human rights, we shall act in accordance with international standards, in accordance with the rule of law. And the second point is that humanitarian concerns shall always be taken into account. To tell the truth, it looks very strange when measures aimed allegedly to protect human rights result in the deaths of those they seek to protect.
It also brings to mind, just briefly here, I always like to end on a positive note with these shows that I record. So I just wanted to ask, do you think there's more of a discussion now about the negative impacts of sanctions? Do you think there's any type of real change starting to occur and maybe an opening up of discussion about these matters in the sort of public discourse?
I believe that the process is just starting. And I need to mention that my mandate is one of the very new ones. It was established only in 2015. So generally speaking, I'm only the second special rapporteur. But still we face serious problems. So still it's very much political. Still there is very low level of awareness also among the states. There are still very little, just a few academic publications assessing legality of unilateral sanctions as well, the humanitarian impact. But the positive point is that they started to appear. People started to discuss. Media started to look at the problem. I will give you an example. The UN High Commissioner on Human Rights did two reports on Venezuela. The first one refers to the violations of human rights. The second one mentioned that besides that violations of human rights, the unilateral sanctions did an enormous impact over human rights situation. If you look at the reports and statements done by the High Commissioner as well as the UN General Secretary General in the course of the pandemic, one of the very important lines in the course of the pandemic was that we all are equal. No one shall be left behind. Sanctions shall be lifted because they make countries more vulnerable in the face of the pandemic. So yes, indeed, even within the year when, well, I took my mandate only on March 2020, within the year in which I'm involved in the problem, I see that the level of awareness as well as the level of discussion is rising, and some understanding is coming. So academics started to pay more attention, states started to pay more attention. So therefore, I believe that I could probably be cautiously positive to the fact that the process of awareness rising has already started.
Well, Dr. Elena Dohan, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. And if you can, let my listeners know how they can keep up with the work you're doing.
I have a web page of the mandate. So that's within the special procedures of the United Nations. If you look in Google, it's just UN Special Rapporteur on the Negative Impact of Unilateral Coercive Measures. And I try to put all the references to the activity taken. It's possible to find all the reports which are done, both thematic or country visit reports, as well as there are references to the main interviews or lectures which were done in this sphere. That page of the mandate is functionable, so it's possible to get access to all these sorts of activities done by me as a mandate holder. Also, what we plan to do a sort of the library for academic works and individual cases on sanctions situation. It's possible to get access to the reports as well. But again, it's also possible to send an individual communications for those who feel that their human rights are affected. And there is a mail of the mandate on the webpage of the mandate as well.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Professor Elena F. Dohan, once again, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Sanctions. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Ben, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.